How do you see this particular project in the development of your work?
To date, I've worked mainly in galleries, in spaces that are very well defined, and interior spaces, and I still enjoy working in those, and I still want to work in those sorts of spaces. But in this particular case, it's an attempt to take an idea outside and in a way try to create a situation whereby what I do works in sympathy with what is already there. Like landscape outside, I think is very difficult to deal with if you're actually putting something outside. In terms of the tradition of sculpture, for example, most sculpture in public places outside sits there as a monument to some kind of idea that has to stay, and I feel at odds with that particular notion, because sculpture to me is really very much an exploratory, very spatial kind of exploratory thing that doesn't necessarily have to stay, because I feel that the difference perhaps between an interior space and somewhere outside is that in an interior space you're actually protected all the time by conditions which outside, through say the effect of weather, wear and tear, things growing, things dying, things living, outside you're confronting all those sorts of issues, and therefore it seems wrong to me to put sculpture in the traditional sense into that kind of environment, because at that point it lacks a certain sort of sympathy with the ongoing organic nature of things. So what I'm really interested in trying to do is to place something in that living, changing landscape that in itself will have its own life and change built into it. And in this particular construction, I'm trying to use the energy, the natural energy, in this case of tides, to affect change within the structure. When the piece of work has... So when the piece of work has reached a stage where I feel that something has been achieved, then it becomes obsolete and can be taken away. At that point, one is left with nothing other than memories and perhaps other developed ideas, which may be, say, a film or video or a book or whatever. But the future then lies in this transcription, and new ones, hopefully at that stage, on new work anyway.
You did a project with a tree growing in a special way, and that could be the reason by the wind or another natural reason. Is the influence of other forces like wind or streamings, is that for you something special? Are you very often busy with that?
Well, I have used in the past things like motors, and I've used sort of mechanical devices to activate something. But now my interest is more in using perhaps more simple, more basic elements to activate work. I try and use the most direct means possible. I'm not interested in using means that are in any sense theatrical, or means that have been devised. In other words, if there is a situation somewhere that I find exciting, then thereafter I have to try and find, first of all, why it's exciting, and then how I can activate another situation whereby those elements come together in a series of ingredients that go into a piece of work that, if the ingredients are right, then one can create a certain sort of thing which I think of as, I suppose, magic, really. I think good art is magical. And to create that magic, one has to be able to find the right ingredients, because it's so easy to miss. And in some of my work, obviously, I have missed. And other pieces, those elements have fused in some sort of way, and something has happened that produces a result that contains, amongst other things, unexpected things emerge. But the thing, if it's good, does take on a certain sort of life of its own, and it becomes mysterious for oneself as an artist, although you've actually made it yourself. That's what I think probably everybody wants to achieve, but it's how one actually gets to that stage, and how clear one's thinking is on when one's in that situation, where you feel that there is a possibility. Once you've felt there's a possibility in something, you then have to try and find out what that possibility is. Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. If you're in a studio, you can carry on this sort of activity in private. If you set up a more large-scale, one-off kind of situation, then you're testing this idea in a very public sort of way, and that puts a certain kind of pressure on you, which is in one sense frightening, but also I suppose I must find that exciting. Have I wandered off the point?
Yeah, you were talking about processing how you work, but what you wanted to say is that you have inside also a kind of process. Inside the gallery space you have also a kind of process in which you build it up so that you do it not alone, but with public.
In work that is time-based, or it goes through a process, then I think it continually has moments of success and failure. You are all the time making this public, and there are times when the work seems to have an amazing future in it, that it is going to be, that it has potential. There are other times when the work seems to say that there's a problem inherent in it. one has to stop and confront. This has happened in some pieces of work. Sometimes the problems have been overcome, so therefore at a later stage it does emerge as being successful. There are other times when the problem has never been solved, and there are other times when it's actually been a total success all the way through. I mean, that's purely in my terms, of course. Not a very easy thing to describe why you feel that something is a success or failure, but I think I often feel that successful work has lived up to the sort of vision that I had of it in the first place. Unsuccessful work is work that's perhaps wandered off from the initial vision, because it's so tempting to become sidetracked all the time, because new possibilities open up all the time, and for all that one has to keep attention on what one really wants to do. And if one does get sidetracked, then often what you're trying to do is try and make two ideas work in one, which is not possible.
What could you have a relation with one of your earlier pieces, The Boat, and the project on the Thames?
Yes, it's very difficult always to try and sort out exactly what relationships are with earlier work, because perhaps one's too interested in future work. Backtracking, going back through one's history, is not as exciting as thinking about future ideas. But often ideas do reflect past interest. You realize that an interest is still continuing. Not always easy to identify, and in fact I don't think one has to spend much time worrying about whether trains of thought are continuing or whatever. I like to feel that in my work I can go off and work with different ideas. Artists that interest me have always attempted different ideas and became involved with different things. It doesn't interest me just to continue one particular train of thought, because I get bored too quickly. But The Boat piece, for example, has now been taken over by the Graving Dock piece. And really, it wasn't till I was setting the Graving Dock piece up that I realized quite how strong the relationship of The Boat piece was to it. I mean, admittedly, it went into the same space. But even details like the colour of this particular piece seem to relate to The Boat piece. People after The Boat piece said to me, "When are you going to do another one?" And I said, "Well, the whole point of it was that one never does another one like that. And I wouldn't want to still be doing pieces of work with boats." Nonetheless, there is a relationship, and maybe that relationship comes through the source material, i.e. the river, water, boats or whatever. I've never really, though, been able to identify quite what it is. But some artists become involved with perhaps landscape, some artists become involved with the human figure. I seem to become very involved with the point where the land stops and the sea takes over.
That brings us to the final question.
Yes, well, I did try, when I was at art school, I did try to run away to sea once, but I couldn't get a ship, so I didn't quite make it because my first art school was just by Tilbury Docks, further downriver. And perhaps I'm rather glad I didn't make it. I think probably my interest isn't so much being out at sea, but that point where water meets the land, that sort of edge of two different types of phenomena, if you like, land and water. I think that's what really interests me, rather than being lost at sea.
And does water mean for your space?
Well, yes, certainly, because, I mean, with the River Thames, for example, it's an enormous area of space in the center of a very enormous city. And in that space, the river space, the tide moves in and moves out, and it remains continuously active, and it seems to have a very strong presence in London. I mean, a lot of big cities have their rivers, through obviously historical, social origins. In the case of London, for example, the historical, social origins have now disappeared in the sense that the river isn't used industrially anymore. In one sense, it's a rather dead river. But nonetheless, it has another quality, which is, I don't know, I just think of it really as a sort of a breath of fresh air or something. I hope we don't use that term. It sounds awful. But I wouldn't really want to actually say why I think the river's good, because I think everybody has their own reasons for enjoying the river, and those reasons are very difficult to put into words, and perhaps because I can't put them into words, I use another language, and I use the language of drawing and sculpture, which I suppose, because I'm an artist, I've decided that that is my language. I think it's particularly the speed and the change of the rise and fall of the tide in the Thames is quite exceptional, in the sense that there aren't a lot of rivers that have such an excessive, there aren't a lot of rivers in going through big cities that are quite as active. It's very dramatic the way the Thames rises, perhaps 15 or 20 feet, I'm not sure what it is. The landscape changes so dramatically. You can be walking on the beach at low tide, and at high tide the water can be almost up to the river wall. And in fact, London is in danger of flooding. If you see the river at low water, you would never realize that it could fill up in such an amazing way. And because it's such an active river in that sense, that it covers so much territory in that very dramatic sort of way, it takes up and down with it a lot of the debris that is in the water. There's debris that floats at all level. I mean, obviously, things like wood float on the surface, but beneath the surface, you come into things like plastic. And as you get deeper down, then it even has the power to move things like, heavier thing.
Motorcycles.
And that's one of the things, I mean, just one aspect of the river, that looking at it, you start to think about something must be going on in the water. It's not very clear water, so you can't see down into it if you, in the same way that you could, say, with water from the Mediterranean. Even if you were a diver, you'd need very strong lights to see what was happening deep down. You never actually see the seabed of the Thames. Presumably it's dredged, and you can find out how deep it is, but you can never quite see the bottom of it. It's never been drained. In fact, it's rising.
You try to show a part of that through the sculpture?
Well, I hope some aspects of that might be revealed. I could get a good designer to design a proper machine for analyzing it in a scientific way. That is a possibility, but that's not really my interest because I'm not a scientist in that sense. But being aware that something is happening in the Thames, I want to use it in my own way, in a way that I hope will express in some way the activity rather than merely give a scientific analysis of it. One wants to try and use what's there to express what's there.
But usually you try on a sculpture what you make to have a kind of influence from outside what makes the sculpture different, not just the piece of metal or the piece of wood or the piece of... And sometimes it is a motor in this last piece, it is the water running. And therefore this piece for sure must be for you important because of the changes of the piece itself and also the additional things that are being given to the piece by the stream.
Yeah, yeah, and it's got to sit there being what it is all the time. As I said earlier, I think nothing will be hidden. So it can't excuse itself in any way. It can't hide behind anything. It's got to be in that position whereby it has a presence within that piece of landscape, the beach, the jetties, seawall, the movement of the water. But it's got to also work in sympathy with what is there. It can't try and compete with what is there, because that I think would be too aggressive and is not in my interest at all. It has to change the situation there, but not in any way try and defeat the situation. It's difficult to describe. Perhaps I should talk about the reason for this piece. First thing that I can remember seeing was a lot of debris washed up into a small creek by a friend's house, and at every tide the formation of this debris would change and move. If a wind came from a different quarter, then the debris would totally disappear. Some bits, the heavy bits, would stay there for forever, obviously. Then I just started thinking about ways in which one could use that and observe that and make that become integrated within a structure that I would lay down there. And it seemed very exciting, and it still seems very exciting, the possibility of looking at the surface of the water at high tide and seeing nothing but the water and the movement in it, and then as the tide drops away, to slowly see construction revealed. And in looking at it, looking at all the changes that occur, if any changes do in fact occur. I mean, I've been out on trawlers in Scotland quite a lot. I used to make films from the trawlers. And trawlers, fishing boats. Yeah. And the thing that was always exciting, not only to me, but to the people working on the trawlers, was when the net came in with the fish, because the fish obviously, first of all, were their money. But secondly, there was that amazing sort of intrigue about what you've caught, if you've caught anything, how much you've caught. And that kind of excitement has always stayed with me. And although this piece won't be about animals, I'll still have that kind of interest. Has anything been caught? And this will change because as the tide comes back in again, possibly things that were there might have moved on. Perhaps they'll stay, I don't know. It's full of those kinds of unknowns, really. Another thing that interests me is that using something like nets is such a traditional means of working with, well, nets in water. Goes back to perhaps prehistoric times, I don't know. But I like to use materials that are traditional in that sense. Using scaffolding in this case, it's a very traditional building material. In more primitive societies, they use wood tied together, but essentially it's a method of getting up into space. You come out of the gallery from the show, you can see it right across the road on a building site, for example. When I did the lifeboat piece in the gallery, it just so happens that a lifeboat is one of the most traditional shapes that one could use. It's a double-ended boat built in a way that's not dissimilar to early Nordic constructions of boats, for example. And in that sense, there you feel that perhaps you're dealing with something that is a sort of universal truth in a way. That kind of shape of boat seems to be the most functional for that job. Historically, that's always been the case. Downstairs, the structure is made from a grid, space grid. It has a certain way of filling space, perhaps a very conventional way of filling space, but the cube or whatever has a sort of meaning that is not foreign to our way of thinking, is something that is universal, but at the same time, every different person will have their own reading of such a thing. So, more...
When did the idea of this piece started? Was that very long ago?
Yes, this piece, first ideas were probably about a year and a half ago, which is quite a long time, really, for me to be thinking about a piece of work, because normally I tend to get ideas carried out as soon as I possibly can. However, if the idea is strong enough, then it seems to survive the test of time. It gets somewhat battered on the way, and it's sometimes difficult to maintain the original intention. But I think in this case, the original intention is still very strong, because the first idea about it was quite overpowering, I suppose.
You did, in the meantime, in the time that the idea is born and or that the idea is growing, and now you did several work what has a direct relation with this piece, like this show and like a lot of drawings, and also a kind of study period with some students. Could you tell me more about that and how it has influenced the piece?
Which students? Babel. Yeah. Well, I was over the last two or three years, I've been doing a lot of drawings to do with different types of structures, and one of the interests that grew out of these drawings was the idea of spirals and structures related to spirals. The idea of I mean, a lot of artists have worked with spirals. There's nothing new there, and again, it's a traditional form that still has a lot of mileage in it. I also used to work with dancers, and I remember that there were a lot of ideas to do with spiral in dance movement. The few paintings by Bruegel interested me, his paintings of the Tower of Babel, whereby the structure was attempted, and inevitably it had to fail because there was only a certain point to which it could go. That the thing about building a tower in that particular case was that it's quite obvious that using a spiral as a form was one of the best ways of doing it, because if you're going to get up into space, which a tower is about, one of the easiest ways of getting up there is to walk round and round and round, and you get to the top that way. So spiral in that sense has a certain kind of practical function. I didn't make a model for the structure because I suppose I felt that it could be done, and the only way to do it was to do it as a real thing. I can't deal with models very well because they're never the real thing. They have their own reality, but the reality of a really large-scale thing, and I enjoy working with large-scale things, is very different from anything you'd ever find in a model. I know architects have to make models, and I know a lot of boat designers, aeroplane designers have to make models and do their various tests or whatever. But I don't necessarily think that the artist has to become involved with that, because they're perhaps trying something different. Something worth thinking about. If you look at, say, the model of an aeroplane, a travel agent's window, say, for example, an aeroplane that I think is amazing, the Concorde. When you look at the real thing, it's a total shock because you're confronting its real scale. And at that point, human scale comes into it, because one is always dealing with human scale. And the excitement for me is perhaps often trying to make things that are a little bit beyond human scale.
About the scale of the piece.
Yeah, well, scale is very important. If you're working in a small confined space, perhaps say a gallery, then obviously you have to work within those limitations. But when you go outside, scale of landscape, particularly by the river on this particular site that we've chosen, is vast. And in I don't think many British artists really use scale in a real sense. There, one feels there's an opportunity to really use the space. Perhaps artists have become so conditioned to making objects and things that go indoors rather than out of doors. Perhaps artists haven't become involved enough with architecture. I mean, architecture now seems terribly removed from work with artists. Here there seems to be an opportunity to just expand, because in fact I want the piece to expand. I want it to start from a small starting point with the idea of elements and grow and grow and grow to a point where one feels that the scale has become sufficient. You can't know this until you try it. You'll be able to take a boat out across the river and look at it from all different points of view or from the land. But you couldn't actually say with this work that it's got to be this size, full stop, because that's one of the things that you find out when you're doing the piece.
Are you not afraid that it's not in harmony with the landscape?
Yes.
What are you doing on it?
Well, there are some very, very powerful shapes and structures all the way down the river. Most of them now obsolete because the trade, ships tying up at docks. That whole trade is finished, it's dying off. There are most amazing bits of marine architectural structures that exist that one almost feels one should take photographs and document them in some sort of way, because now they're becoming dilapidated. Nonetheless, these very powerful shapes are there all the way down, because the River Thames changes so much. From I've covered most of the River Thames in boats from its source right out in the country, in English country landscape, right down through suburban places like Staines, Chertsey, right through where the tide meets the fresh water at Richmond, right down through London, City of London, and then down to the area that I'm interested in, which is Dagenham, where it becomes very industrial, and it's not a very public place because people can't get easy access to the river at that point, if in fact they want to, because it becomes very muddy and quite desolate and flat, and the only things that exist are old jetties and industrial sites like Ford's car works at Dagenham, power station at Beckton, which I think is now disused, a few odd creeks, but not a lot of river traffic, only tugs and oil boats and gravel boats, and the ferry that takes the workers across to Ford's at Dagenham, which is just by the site. So it's not very public, but at the same time, when you stand on the beach, it's a very quiet place to be, and I think it's a sort of place where you can actually think about what you want to do without worrying too much about being in the public eye, because in this particular situation I know that the structure may have to change, and I don't want it to be seen as a public event in that sense. I want to be able to use the beach as a workshop and a place to experiment, and I want to be able to change ideas, and I don't want to have to be responsible for in any way presenting some kind of entertainment to a public. And there'll be a group of people working there who I hope will be as involved with that experiment as I will, and will feel a certain kind of freedom to experiment. So it's almost like being in a private studio but in a landscape at the same time.
For you, the process of working and the fact that the public is there is, in the other work, quite important. Here, it's actually more the working group, I think, because the public cannot really quite be assistant, be there when you build it up. What do you expect that the experience will be of the public? How will they see the piece?
Well, that's a question that I've never been able to answer, and I've often been asked it, because I think the most one can do is to produce the work, the attempt, and thereafter public have to form their own opinions about the piece, because if the piece is finished, if the artist declares the piece finished, then it has its own life thereafter, and it's almost as though it doesn't belong to the artist anymore. It becomes public property, and it has to stand up and answer for itself, I suppose. So I suppose you hope that a public is going to experience some of the things that you've experienced in the construction of it. It's a very difficult one, though. I used to work more with process work whereby the changes could be continually observed, but just recently I've tended to work a little bit more privately. I don't feel the necessity to show off every single changing idea that I have. I'm happy at the end of it to make the thing public, but I feel that I've coped with all that and it's not necessary to the things I do anymore.
In this case, the group will influence the changes with you, and the technicians, or you are yourself the constructor, but I could imagine that you have some people who have some experience working with scaffolding or working with...
I often do, in fact most pieces of work, I do work with other people, and they may not realize it, but I rely on them very much for input. I couldn't work with somebody who I felt wasn't interested, for example, because the work, if it interests me at all, then it's exploratory. And if it's exploratory and other people are working alongside you, then they have to participate in that exploration. So in that sense, the work is ultimately a collaborative piece, although I may have originated the idea. So other people are very important when they're working with me. With this structure, there's, I've gone through a lot of ideas, a lot of possibilities, ways in which it could be made. In doing so, you have to think about the strength of the tide. The tide, tidal strength is enormous. So that kind of energy mustn't be underestimated in what one does. I mean, I've had experience with boats and the way even to moor a boat on the Thames properly, one has to have experience, otherwise the tide will change and you'll come back and find the boat has broken free of its moorings, or the height of the river has changed dramatically, or the wind has got up and it's become quite a different sort of river. So the other thing was that I didn't want to go to great lengths of employing heavy industrial plant to drill great big holes in the beach, or in fact affect what is already there. I really want to just work with what is already there in the most direct, simple sort of way. So now possibility is coming up of working with structures that are based on a pyramid, which is a very strong structure, and spreading the structure so it actually lays on the surface of the beach but has enough weight to stay there without the tide pulling it away. But like the graving dot piece in the Acme Gallery, where one shape is being stressed out of another shape, my interest is also in trying to take a structure to a point where if it was extended any further, it could actually fail. If a mathematician came along and looked at some of my structures, then I'm sure they could say this is wrong, that's wrong, that could be improved, or whatever. And they'd be quite right. But I like to try and work with structures more rather intuitively than working it out through a mechanical computer.
Yeah, the piece downstairs here in the Acme Gallery, is that, you mentioned just now that it are two structures weaving through each other. Was that your basic setup, or did that grow during the working, when you worked at it?
No, the original idea was that there were going to be two structures, one a supporting foundation structure, and
that's
then another,
the square.
And then another one grows out of it. So I started at the back of the gallery, and very soon we realized that the square cuboid structure isn't very strong, so that had to become triangulated with cross pieces, because a triangle is very strong. But we started from the back of the gallery, moving through to the front, and it was rather like building a basket, really. When the first shape had been completed, or before the first shape had been completed, the second shape had to start to be woven into it. And I have some photographs of some eel traps that somebody showed me, where with any basket structure, these eel traps were made as like a basket. You have the long members, the main members, the sort of guidelines, and then everything that comes in thereafter adds to the structure, and a kind of space grows along the shape. But it reminded me of a basket when I was making it. Yeah. And that bit in the middle, where the two meet, was the most complicated part. You know, I mean, that was like we got up to that stage, to it. We did that in about 2 or 3 days, congratulating ourselves on how fast we were going. And then suddenly we hit mesh, you know. One coming into the other, and you find one scaffold pole would hit there and that hit there. Can't do that.
That makes the total very interesting, because that's you oversee this. You it's difficult to oversee the structure,
right.
And you think first that it is a kind of
random system, and then slowly, if you look very carefully, you see that there is a kind of weaving structure through each other, and that makes it interesting.
Yeah. And there are tremendous stresses on those long shapes that come out. A fantastic weight on that scaffold.
Yeah.
You don't realize until you. But the pressure, if you look at it from that side door, you can see them all bowing like that.
Yeah.
Amazing tension. And if we'd continued that shape any further, it would be in danger of collapsing and pulling that back one up, you see.
Yeah.
So we actually had to stop at that point where we felt, you know, to go any further, the whole thing would...
Be nice on the end of the show.
That's theatre then, you see.
the front part is lifted from the floor, right?
Yes. Yes, that moves up, up and up. Now it's trying to get down, obviously, all the time. And if it had started to fall, which it was doing, we had marks on the wall, we could see the whole shape slowly going down as we were working. If it had dipped like that, then the energy would have gone out of the piece. You know, that would have been it, finished.
But you told me just now that you worked on one structure on one side and on the other structure on the other, and then...
No, I didn't. No.
No, that's
no.
Not...
I started from the back of the gallery.
Yeah.
Coming forward, all the time coming forward. I mean, I could have...
So where did it met then?
In the middle.
Yeah, but...
Right. So I got to that point.
Yeah.
And the other bit now had to start to grow forward as well. But the angle changed.
Yeah, yeah. And the full weight and the full construction met in the middle. That's what you start.
Well, that's where the enormous pressure is.
Yeah.
But I didn't start at one end and the other. I just started it. Because it had to move forward. You see, with this piece on the Thames, I got this idea that it must just grow from somewhere. You know,
yeah.
Like, move out.
That's how the several elements fit in each other.
Sure, sure. How the type move.
Are you sure already about the element, each element? I mean, you have the basic ideas, the fire?
Yeah. Well...
Since our last...
I feel that's good. Yeah, that's good.
Because when you started to make the lines, you changed.
Well, yes, sure, sure. But they were becoming too mechanistic, you know. I mean, the situation from that studio to the beach is so different. You know. And really, it's not a great problem. And if there are three or four people there with brains in their head and time, you know, one can do it. It's, there are certain things that one has to sort out, obviously. But, I mean, with the school kids, with the Tower of Babel, it was a matter of going out there with bits of scaffolding and just starting, you know. There's a sort of belief that it can happen. To have gone out there with something constructed would have just been boring. That's not the experience that one's looking for, is it?
Could you compare your work with other artists? This work of other artists?
Yeah, but they don't half look shoddy compared to me.
No, but you.
Well, there are other artists whose work, obviously, I feel some affinity with. Other artists with attitudes towards work that I feel a very strong affinity with. But you only do these things, really, because you think you're... Well, what do you mean by the question, sir?
think it could make, for example, somebody who never saw your work more clear,
yeah,
that you could compare it with other work,
yeah,
but at the same time say the difference.
Well, I think, really, I feel at odds with other artists. You know what I mean by at odds?
Odds?
I feel...
Odds, I mean, sort of strange.
Yeah. Yes. Perhaps I don't feel any close affinity with other artists. Not most artists, anyway.
You feel yourself a sculptor?
Well, that's a handy term to use.
You work.
Yeah.
And you mentioned already that you are also on the level of architecture, scale work.
Yeah.
In any case, this
way. Yeah. I mean, most of... well, let's not go into a long time.
No. I want you to tell me a little bit more about how you work together with other people and how far it is your interest that they have the same kind of experience as yourself by building up the people.
Well, I don't think they have the same kind of experience, although when I'm working with other people, there is a very strong communication between us, because I can't work with people who are just simply labourers. They have to be emotionally involved in the thing, because the structures that I've worked with are new. They haven't been tried before. So the whole thing is exploratory right from the word go, and in that sense the people who I work with are having to attempt to solve the problems of the work in the same way as I am. And I mean, in a way the structures are very simple, although you may have to think very hard about the way the technical problems involved, and I suppose inevitably the aesthetic problems involved. See, usually they are on such a scale that I would actually find it impossible to do it on my own physically anyway. Just putting two scaffolding poles together actually requires, in most cases, two people. Scale, as well as requiring other people to work on, becomes exciting because it also means that one has to climb over the things. So they're actually larger than human scale. And if you're climbing on a structure that you're building, you have a very different relationship to that thing than, say, if you were modelling something small in your hand. Instantly you have a kind of a view and a feeling about the thing, which in one sense you're smaller than it, and being smaller than it is something that's always excited me, I suppose.
When you did the pieces I saw now, the Graving Dog, for example, you have also kind of size that people can experiment the piece on their own body, because it is the size, but also the water you really feel and the smell you really... could you imagine that you made smaller objects?
At this point in time, no. I suppose the next two pieces of work that I'm going to do, one in Oxford, is probably, in terms of size, be the biggest piece I've ever done so far. nonetheless, the next Thames project will be even bigger than that. What was the question?
The question is why you have that size. Is it true that people has to experience that with their own body, not only on a distance looking, but really be into it?
Yes, I think so. I always like one of the things when I was very, very interested in Greek sculpture was the fact that Greeks often built their Colossus figures over life size. When I was a student and I had to make life figures in sculpture, it always used to amaze me that if you made a model of the human figure that was only a foot larger than the real size, it suddenly became something totally different. One had a totally different relationship to it. If you did a modeled a figure half human size, it never somehow seemed to work. It's curious the way scale does affect things. Even if it's the same piece of work, there seems to be a right and a wrong scale for it. Often scale is dictated by where you're doing a piece. I mean, if you're in an interior space such as a gallery, then the gallery obviously has to be taken into account. In some galleries, I've overreached myself, thinking that I can feel, like, give some feeling in the space, and found that the piece of work simply isn't big enough. With the Acne Gallery that I know well as a space, I find I can deal with it. It is actually within my scale. The piece that I'm going to do outside in Oxford reaches out onto a playing field, so the landscape there is enormous. That doesn't mean to say the sculpture's got to fill the landscape, but it has to be of a certain size before it has any relevance. And that size is dictated both by the person, the human scale, being there within the scale of the landscape. The Thames itself is a strange kind of scale because it's always changing. At high tide, the river's swollen and flooded, and at low tide, it's smaller and quieter. And that alters one's sense of the river a tremendous amount.
In the Thames project, people cannot actually touch it. I mean, they're passing with a boat, so you have to work only through the eyes and perhaps through the fact that they are in the water.
Yes, well, people could actually get off a boat and go and touch it if the boat was small enough to do that. But, I mean, when you're at sea in a boat, you often pass structures that are man-made, such as buoys, navigational buoys, and you pass them very closely in your boat. But because they sit there in water and appear not to have any human presence on them, almost as though a human being has never actually been there, they have their own sort of mystery. And although I've often passed close to buoys on my boat and stopped the boat, I've never actually climbed onto one. There's something about its presence in water that has a strange sort of alienation. And likewise, I think the jetties that stick out in the river, I mean, they're marvellous architectural structures in themselves, they somehow sort of resist, or even if one does go in and climb amongst them or whatever, there's always that feeling that they belong to some other kind of world. For a start, they're going to be covered with water if you go onto them at low water, for example, low tide. Things coming out of water in that way have their own sort of presence that they wouldn't have if they were put into a normal landscape, or if they wouldn't, or if they were put into, say, a gallery space or an interior space. In other words, every space has its own mood, and one does have to deal with that mood. And in this case, the mood, as I said, with tidal action is a changing one, and that determines.
If you could compare the Thames with a space, a real space, like a gallery space, then the fact that you are on the water, you are part of the space where the sculpture is. The fact that you see the sculpture is that, as far as you see it, is the space where the sculpture is built in.
Sorry, I don't quite understand.
No, exactly.
That's quite an interesting point, because you were talking about the space of being on the water and the space of being on land. Something that I was continuously aware of when I used to go around in my boat was the fact that walking up a river on the river edge and looking at the river was a totally different experience from being on the river in a boat, although you're more or less in the same area. This is particularly true, say, with London, a big city. When I used to get off my boat in the morning and walk up the jetty, I was suddenly in the space of business and movement and traffic, whatever. Just walking down onto the boat, you were involved in a totally different... Really, it's a sort of... a mood, emotional thing. The space is a sort of mood, emotional thing. I mean, it's just as mysterious being on land as it is being on water. I suppose the fact that we can survive easier by being on land makes us feel more sympathy with it. But then, why do you have seamen who go to sea for most of their lives? They must feel they must feel much closer to water than somebody who lives on land who wouldn't want to be at sea. I mean, but then isn't it something like 4/5 of the world is covered by water? There's some,
yeah.
You might check up on that. Is that all right? I haven't answered your question. Someone's still there.
You think you can overbridge the size of the Thames?
Overbridge?
Yeah, make the sculpture as visible as being there.
Yeah, this is one of the. One of the things that's got to work, the scale that we work on, has got to be strong enough to have presence within that landscape, although at the same time we don't want to in any way dominate the landscape. I mean, just a few hundred yards upriver from where the site is, there are two enormous pylons that take cables across the river. They're a fantastic height. The Eiffel Tower is an enormous structure. What I have to do is try and work on a scale that is within my means and at the same time allow it to have a presence that I think will be rather quiet, a quiet sort of presence. I mean, it's a quiet sort of beach. Something that you might possibly miss, but then you see when you're on the water, when you're on a boat, for some reason I find I become hyper aware. I'm looking for things, marks all the time. Perhaps it's to do with the fact that there aren't any roads. You're looking for buoys, or you're looking for some navigational point, or you're looking for some obstruction in the water. It's such a sort of quiet landscape in one sense that on any ship there is somebody on lookout all the time. It's not like driving a lorry down a road where you know what the signs are all the way and somebody else is directing you. You're actually directing yourself. So in that sense, I think being going down the river, one would probably pick it up. You would pick up the fact that something different was happening on a part of the beach. The rhythm of looking at the edges of the river would suddenly be changed because there would be a presence of something there. Then, if one wants to get in further and investigate, you know, then one gets more information about the piece of work. But I get the feeling that probably it'd be looked at through binoculars as much as anything, because everybody on a ship has binoculars, and they're always using them.
How do you think, that was a question I asked you already in the other tape, in the other interview, how do you think the public can experience the things? Then you left the answer very open. And what I really want to know is, like, I'm sure when with the graving dog here, that you really walked also like you was public, and felt all the different feelings the public would experience when they saw this piece. Are you already doing that with the piece on the Thames?
Well, you can only speculate about what the public might think about a piece of work. I think people enjoy being curious, and in a sense, if things are put on the walls of galleries, it could be argued that you're denying them a lot of their curiosity, because you say, here is an exhibition space, come in, and you're going to see some art on the walls. Whereas in this case, if our publicity goes out and people become aware of the fact that there is something on the river in perhaps a more private kind of area, if they really are truly curious, then they will go and investigate. How they investigate it is up to them, because I'm not trying to present the thing in a conventional public way. Do you see what I mean? I'm trying to say it's asking people themselves to be as curious as they possibly can be, rather than giving something that's easily accessible.
Yeah. And you are also thinking that it is changing a lot. I don't think that people will come back if they saw it once. Only a few people will come back regular. Say, when 20 people do that, it's a lot.
Well, I don't think artists can be accountable for people's personal reactions to anything. So, the thing is, this isn't a totally private piece of work. There is access to it, although the access is more difficult than most artworks. Therefore, you may find the audience are people who never go to art galleries. I don't know who they might be, but you know, for example, it is just by a place where a lot of workers go to the car works. I'm not going to stand there and sort of preach to them about what I'm doing, but it would be evident what I'm doing. At the same time, it's not so public that it can be swarms of people can arrive. I mean, the work is happening in a curious situation, and I like that aspect of it. I can't quite tell you why I want to do it in that situation, but I feel it's part of it. That remoteness about it is part of the way I feel about, as I said earlier, a lot of things that one witnesses at sea, you know, the sort of dereliction of marshland or places where one can't easily get to, or where you have to put yourself out to get to. you know, that must come into it. At one time I was thinking of doing it, as I spoke to Josine, further upriver, outside of a riverside pub. But if one did it there, you would become so public, you'd become like a sort of animal performing to a, you know, a public. And that's not right either.
Another question. I think I know enough about this subject, how you think about how the people will receive it. The other question is there humor in your work?
Humor? On numerous occasions I suddenly burst out laughing about what I'm doing, but that's probably my own quirky sense of humor. I like to think there is an element of humour in it, yes. I think it's probably something as simple as suddenly asking myself, what the hell I think I'm doing, really. I find that comical.
For example, a combination of materials could be humoristic. What I thought that was a little bit humoristic was the primitive way you dripped the water over the sculpture.
Mm.
Kind of nearly childish setup. Although, and you, the hiding of the... same time you could see it, but it was a kind of primitive way in what I thought you would enjoy that in a humoristic way.
Yes, yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. Some people said to me that you are already an established artist. Do you feel yourself like an experienced artist?
Well, I feel more experienced now, in some respects, than I did, say, 10 years ago. In some respects, because one has been through certain situations that have been either good or bad, you do tend to feel stronger about your capabilities anyway. Very often, of course, one feels totally barren and anxious. But experience, I think, is to do with knowing that in the past you've managed to achieve something or other. And therefore, you perhaps assume that you can do it again. But so experienced in that way, but inexperienced in the sense that there are so many things that are possible to try that you can't, you might have the idea in your mind, but you haven't found out a way of articulating it. So in that sense, you're inexperienced. I don't know what my bank manager thinks about that.
In any case, it's not the owning of the money that shows that you are an established artist.
No, I can prove that. I think what the experience part of it does allow you to do is, one, if you have some kind of track record, then you find that people are more trusting when you come up with an idea, say for new work. And that is very useful, because some things are very complicated to organize. When you're younger, you have to go around trying to convince people all the time. And you have to go through that. There's no shortcut to that. And there's nothing wrong with that. And I've no doubt I still have to do that. But when people are trusting in you, I suppose that does help to boost a little. I'm not saying this very well.
No, but I think I understand what you mean. It's you need not to create an entree, a new entree for yourself. The entree is the work you did before.
Sure.
And that makes it easier in the contact and in the trust.
I mean, a lot of people entirely distrust me. I mean, that's inevitable. That, I mean, a lot of people have absolutely no knowledge of this area of work. Other people have total mistrust of this area of work. I don't particularly think I can ever change that, because I know that will continue.
All your pieces have been built with a lot of effort and then has been shown. They have to go away after a while. Next to the fact that you are happy with the people who make a kind of image out of it, so that it exists through another medium, how are your personal feelings when you have to break down these pieces?
Well, often with a sense of relief, actually, because the making of it is a very important part. Once the work has been made and it's served its purpose, I just don't see any necessity for it to stay. And it is often with a sense of relief that when I see the work go, because it actually clears my mind as much as anything for the next piece of work. If work hangs around, as it often does, say, in the studio with drawings or whatever, I often find they can actually hold you back, you know, they stop you seeing clearly the next piece or whatever. I mean, even in terms of compiling the book for Der Appel, I'm having to research a lot of past work and go back, and I have to be very careful that I don't get too involved in that, because I mean, at the moment in the back of my mind is a new piece of work in Oxford and a new drawing that I want to start, and they have to be quite clear, you know, like I have to reserve that part for them, because otherwise you're just dealing with your history, and that's, in a way, one's history is, I think, is more for other people to enjoy. I don't think artists themselves are the best people to deal with it, shall I say that, really. And in the past, good archiving or good criticism or good research has never been done by the artists themselves. It's done by people who have a genuine interest in the continuum of art, although they don't have to be practitioners themselves. And if they are practitioners themselves, I think they often come across a lot of problems, because it's a different thing, you know, it's a different activity, it's a different enjoyment.
On the other hand, you're working for a time, in a year, in a space, in a time, and you are dealing with your surrounding from that moment. You never can test whether the work is overwinning. The time can deal with, say, the years, and whether it is still interesting after, say, 5-6 years, because it is existing.
Sure. But some work is interesting in the sense that people still talk about pieces that happened a few years ago for various reasons. Other work doesn't get talked about. I mean, I have my own private ideas about the stronger pieces and the weaker pieces, but it is interesting to find out other people's assessment of them, you know. People tend to associate one particular piece of work with an artist. I mean, Carl André will always be thought about for his bricks. Friends who know my work often talk about the early boat piece. You know, people like to have a sort of peg to hang things on. I would like to feel that that could be continually challenged and sort of disrupted, you know, the fact that I'm not dealing with suspended lifeboats anymore. I find a great, it's like a thrill really that I'm not, because I don't want to become entangled with history in that sense, and that goes back to the thing of why I like the thing to actually disappear. I mean, if I was Henry Moore, I think I'd get pretty fed up with having to talk continuously about a King and Queen piece that I did in 1951, as well as have it come back to my studio for polishing year after year. So whether my work is literary, I suppose I've always had a fear of things being literary. Often by giving them a title, you give them some sort of literary connotation. In other words, if you call something Graving Dock, and people come in and they expect to see a Graving Dock, if they know what a Graving Dock is. I try not to be too literary, or I try to make the work a translation of a phenomena or an idea. Yeah, I don't want to be too mysterious about it, because this is the problem with trying to avoid being literary. You can force yourself into being mysterious, and I don't think any of my work is essentially mysterious. It's, although it can produce a mystery. if something is literary, it reads directly, and there is no interpretation required on behalf of the onlooker, and it stops any movement from that point on. It can't go beyond itself if it's literary. And good art should go beyond itself.
Yeah, an experience can also be literary. You can give people an experience,
yeah,
so that they have so much associations.
Yeah.
Although the piece itself is not literally or comes.
Sure.
Experience can give all different.
Onlookers, yeah, do tend to put literary translations onto,
yeah,
work, and that's fine.
Yeah,
that's fine, because they're very often not the same ones. Mm. If they were all the same ones, then I think there's a problem with the work.
Yeah, is that also a reason why you don't like to explain, or why you always are a bit walking around describing a piece?
I think so, because if the work's any good, then I'm in the same position as the audience, really. I'm making associations myself all the time.